What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to New Books in Israel Studies. I'm Yaakov Yadgar, the host of the channel. Today we will be talking to Professor Yaakov Rabkin about his new book, What is Modern Israel? Rabkin, a professor of history at the University of Montreal, discusses in this book some of the most fundamental issues pertaining to the history and sociopolitics of Israel. He does not shy away from dealing with some of the most sensitive and even controversial issues, such as the Christian roots of Zionist ideology, the commemoration and political uses of the Holocaust in Israel, and the problematic stance of Zionist ideology towards Jewish traditions. Professor Rabkin, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
I was wondering if you could begin by telling us a little bit about the background of writing this book. You haven't always dealt with Israel in your research, have you?
Indeed. It's the second book I wrote about Zionism in Israel. My previous book, which in English is called A Threat from Within, A Century of Jewish Opposition to Zionism, came out in French first. I wrote both of them in French, and this one also is translated into English. So that book got around the world, including Japan. And in Japan, it was considered one of the best books of the year, and I was asked by the Japanese publisher to write a book about modern Israel for young Japanese readers. Uh-huh. So this is the background of the book. I wrote it essentially, well, I wrote it in French, but I wrote it for Japanese readership. But once I wrote it in French, it came out in French, Russian, English, and so on.
Oh, fascinating. Well, you open the book with, maybe it's anecdotal, but you open it with the metaphor of St. Petersburg as maybe alluding to your position towards your subject of study. Can you elaborate a little bit about this for people who haven't read the book? What is the story of St. Petersburg and why would you present it in the introduction to a book about Israel?
It was done, the comparison between St. Petersburg and the establishment of Israel was done by Professor Harshab, and I'm quoting him. But I found that comparison quite compelling because I was born and I grew up in Leningrad, which is now St. Petersburg. St. Petersburg is a very artificial city. It was built in a very inhospitable environment in early 18th century. Mm-hmm. By essentially the imperial will of Peter the Great. And many writers who lived in St. Petersburg and resented it foresaw that it would be one day destroyed by the sea, that it will be inundated and so on. And that's why I think Harshav made the comparison, but he also made another comparison between the human cost of building it. Some people say that St. Petersburg is built on the bones of thousands of peasants who were mobilized to do the work. And Harshav actually compares it with victims and of the whole Zionist project, that both on the side of the Zionists themselves and the local population.
Mm-hmm. Now, I think one of the more surprising elements you discuss in your book, surprising for people who have maybe just studied the mainstream Zionist historical narrative, has to do with the Christian roots of this ideology. Can you tell us a little bit about that? Many people commemorate nowadays, this year, the Balfour Declaration. It's the centennial for the Balfour Declaration. And you also note that Balfour himself and the roots from which he emerges and the declaration emerges are not necessarily wholly Jewish in their makeup.
Well, indeed, there are several books that have been written about the Christian roots of Zionism. Well, the idea of creating a state for the Hebrews, as they used to say in the 19th century, is an idea that was formulated, articulated, and promoted essentially by English-speaking Protestant Christians, evangelicals, who consider that a Jewish state, a return of the Jews, of the Hebrews, to the Holy Land would speed the second coming of Christ. Mm-hmm. And this goes back to the 17th century. There are important intellectuals like Joseph Priestley in Britain in the 18th century, Lord Shaftesbury in 19th century Britain. So there's a whole background of tremendous attention to the Holy Land. In fact, I think it was Lloyd George, Prime Minister of Britain, who said that he knows the geography of Palestine better than he knows geography of Great Britain. There was a very, and still is, a very strong connection between these Protestant groups, and I don't mean all the Protestants, some Protestant groups, and the idea of ingathering of Hebrews into the Holy Land for the purpose of the second coming of Christ. And indeed, the scenario is not particularly pro-Jewish, I would say, because the idea is to gather them and then there will be a second coming of Christ, and the Jews gathered in the Holy Land would have a choice of recognizing Jesus as Messiah or perishing. I think Gershon Gorenberg, an Israeli writer, once put it, it's a play in five acts and we disappear in the fourth one.
Yes, I think it also involves a different or a renewed reading of the meaning of Jewish identity. To paraphrase what you say in the book, this is a perspective that sees Jews by what they are, not necessarily but what they do or what do they believe or what they observe.
Yes, I think everyone could see that, that in today's Jewish world, and I'm talking about mainstream Jewish communities, with the exception perhaps of most Haredi or ultra-Orthodox groups, the connection with the State of Israel, with the Zionist project, with blessings for the state and the Israeli soldiers, have taken center place in their religious life. If you go to many synagogues, which are kind of modern, maybe conservative or modern Orthodox, you would see that there is a rather sort of attitude towards traditional prayers rather indifferent. But when it comes to the blessing for the State of Israel, everyone stands up and chanting, and there's a lot of emotion. So I think today, for many Jews, I cannot say most Jews, but for many Jews, identification with the State of Israel has replaced traditional Jewish commitment. And this indeed is one of the reasons that the rabbis and most Jewish intellectuals at the turn of the 20th century rejected Zionism, because they foresaw that that's precisely what would happen.
Would you agree that what you present in your book is now your Jewish critique of Israel? you take a more, if in your previous book you've taken a more, an overview take on a century of Jewish opposition to Zionism, this book seems to be feeding on your own Jewish commitments, which translate into critique of Zionism.
That may be right. The book has over 500 references, and essentially it's a book written for people who want to learn more about the history of Zionism and contemporary Israel. Some of the chapters are informed by this Jewish critique of Zionism, because having worked on the subject for over 15 years, I think some of it may have percolated. And I think that the book is not written with a political angle, as far as I can tell, but it does try to distance itself from the dominant Zionist narrative.
I see. And I think in this regard, one of the insights that you provide in the book, which tends to be missing, I think, from much of the conversation on Israel, has to do with the Russian roots of the Zionist project as a whole and Israel as the culmination of this project. In other words, one of the ways you suggest we should view Israel is as a product of Russians of the 20th century. Can you elaborate a little bit on this?
Right. I would gladly do so, because several readers noticed that this Russian dimension is something that they had not been aware of, and I'm grateful to you for bringing it up. The Russian dimension is essential, because we associate the Zionist project with Herzl and with a group of German-speaking intellectuals in Vienna. But in fact, they were generals without an army. The army, that is, the foot soldiers of Zionism, came practically all from the former Russian Empire. And when I mean Russian Empire, it included then Poland and the Baltic states and so on. And if you look at their particular predicament at the turn of the 20th century, unlike Jews in Western Europe and Central Europe, they had not been emancipated. They did not enjoy civil equality, but they had already been largely secularized, and the Haskalah, the Jewish Enlightenment, had affected them by then, and they became extremely sensitive to the Zionist message. So the first settlers, as you well know, came from the Russian Empire, and I think, if I'm not mistaken, there has not been one prime minister of Israel who had not been born within the Russian Empire, or his parents coming from the Russian Empire. And of course, there's many, many others. They changed their names, they Hebraized their names, so it's hard to tell that Yitzhak Rabin is of Russian origin, or Shimon Peres, and so on. And of course, David Ben-Gurion. So we are talking about a very important dimension, and in fact, a confirmation of that is the fact that when former Soviet Jews arrived in Israel en masse in early 90s, very fast they adjusted to the system, they became a political force. Many of them today play important roles in contemporary Israel, unlike immigrants from Yemen or from Morocco, who didn't adjust so easily, because indeed the Zionist project, incarnated Zionist project, is essentially a Russian product. And that's why it's so natural for those who came from the former Soviet Union to benefit from it and to find themselves integrated in the system much better than practically any other immigrants wave.
And where do you see the incarnations of this Jewish of this Russian origins in contemporary Israeli culture? What would you be considering as an obviously Russian trait that we might overlook and just consider as simply Israeli?
Well, I think Russia and the former Soviet Union was the only place in the world where to be a Jew meant to belong to a Jewish nationality rather than a confession. You know, As I mentioned, I grew up in the Soviet Union, and I belonged to the Jewish nationality, which means that it was an ethnic group, it was an ethnic identification, and it had nothing to do whatsoever with religion. This was very important for the entire Zionist project, is to identify Jews not as a confessional group, not as a group that somehow is related to Torah and commandments and all that, but rather as an ethnic or national group, just like Ukrainians, Lithuanians, and Poles, in the midst of whom these early Zionists lived. So I think that the whole idea of Zionist Jewish identity is essentially Russian. Mm-hmm. Even though, of course, it had been proposed by Herzl, a thoroughly assimilated Jew, who also felt that he belonged ethnically to the Jewish people. But as we know, the confessional dimension of Jewish identity practically plays no role unless it's politically manipulated. But it's important to see that in no other country, Jews were considered a nationality.
I see. You also make a connection between these Russian roots and the preference of violence or the use of violence.
Right. It's very interesting because many of those early Zionists came from background of the Russian Revolutionary Movement, which was pretty violent because the Russian imperial government didn't allow expression of political opinion till 1905. So in the late 19th century and early 20th century, terrorism played a very important role in Russian history, violence from revolutionary groups, and Jews were disproportionately represented among those groups because they felt particularly frustrated in their lives with the limitations of the Pale of Settlement and so on. So this culture of political violence was exported with these people to Palestine. And there's something else which is very important. I think most Zionist leaders came from small Jewish towns, from the shtetls. They had no experience, or very little experience, of big cities, international, cosmopolitan environment. I think the only one who came from a cosmopolitan big city, and he didn't quite make it in Zionist history, was Vladimir Jabotinsky, who came from Odessa, but practically all the others came from small towns. And for them, coexistence with non-Jews was something very alien. So they reproduced the same segregation that they were accustomed to in the Zionist project. And in fact, the word that was used, I think, quite early in Zionist history was afrada. Afrada meaning separate development. Mm-hmm. And the Zionist institutions developed in total divorce from the society that existed in Palestine at that time.
And how would you judge the way these Russian roots influence Jews who are not from Russia? You mentioned the fact that non-Russian Jews who immigrated to Israel have had a much tougher route, in a sense. But there's also, as you say, there's a different horizon of meaning here. The way Judaism is understood is completely different than the way other communities understood it. How would you judge the interaction between this Russian conception of the Jewish blood, I would say, and other traditional understanding of Judaism?
Well, I think that the idea of Jewish nationality, or as you put it, the Jewish blood, is an idea that, of course, is present in the Jewish tradition, but it is never a dominant factor, and the dominant factor traditionally was the observance of commandments and certain life style, that, you know, observing of Sabbath and observing of holidays and so on. and dietary restrictions and family restrictions and so on. So for Soviet Jews, all of these things were totally unknown when they came to Israel. Not only didn't observe them, they didn't know about them. So their only connection was the national connection. And that's why they became so well adjusted. Now, for the others, I used to read the Russian press in Israel when I visited Israel. I found it pretty racist. It was pretty racist, not only with respect to Palestinian Arabs, but also to Arab Jews who came from Morocco, Yemen, and other countries, because these Russian Jews felt, and I think continue to feel, as the vanguard of European settlement in the Middle East, and they didn't want to have anything to do with these retarded, backward people from Arab countries. For them, really, the real Israel is a European settlement in the middle of the Middle East, rather than a country integrated in the environment in which it finds itself.
Yes. So what is the meaning of Jewish identity in contemporary Israel? What is the meaning of Israel being a Jewish state?
Well, I'll have difficulty answering that question. And in a good Jewish habit of answering a question with a question, what is a Jewish table? Is it a table produced by a Jew, used by a Jew, sold by a Jew? A table that has kosher food on it. We don't know what the Jewish table is, and that's we don't know what the Jewish state is, because Jewish state, for some people, it's a state where Jews constitute a demographic majority. For others, it should be a throne for the coming of Messiah. That's for many religious Zionists. For the ultra-Orthodox, it means, again, something else. I think, as you know, Israeli society is very fragmented, and attitudes towards the state also quite different. So I really have difficulty to answer your question.
I see. And in the same light, how would you describe the way Israeli Jews understand their Judaism?
Well, again, Israeli Jews is a very diverse group, very fragmented group. So if you take... Let's take from the ultra-Orthodox Haredi groups, and I begin with them not only because I wrote a book about their opposition to Zionism, but also because they are demographically the most dynamic group among Jews. Mm-hmm. So for them, a state is a state like any other state. Some actually don't even recognize it. Those who recognize and take part in political life consider it's an opportunity to get funds for their schools, for their system, but essentially they don't want to integrate into Israeli society, the mainstream Israeli society. That's one group. And the state is not particularly important. What is important is the land, all the land. If you go to the so-called secular majority, I think for them, Jewish state means essentially a demographic majority of Jews in that state without any particular coloration of Judaism. In fact, many of them resent the fact that in many cities in Israel you don't have public transportation and on Shabbat and so on. So for them, they take it as a state where they grew up. Many of them are fifth, sixth generation there. And they want it to be a society like any other Western society. I don't think they have any particular expectations. No. And then, of course, you know, since you yourself taught at Bar-Ilan University, you know that there are religious Zionists for whom the Jewish state has a Jewish meaning. For them, it is it's a step towards the arrival of Messiah, and that's preparing the arrival of Messiah as the blessing for the state of Israel, which I mentioned earlier, very prudently states it's the beginning of the flowering of our redemption. So for them, it is this Jewish state has a very strong meaning. And I think among all the groups that I've mentioned, religious Zionists developed their thought around the Jewish state in a much more convincing way than any other groups that I've mentioned.
Yes, and you offer an interesting play of words when you don't call this group national religious Zionist, but rather national Judaism. Can you explain this?
Well, because the term is Dati Lumi in Hebrew. Dati mm-hmm. meaning religious, Lumi meaning national. And that I translated it directly. And I think it makes a lot of sense because if you call it national Judaism, that's exactly what it is because it combines elements of Jewish tradition with this Russian perception of Jews as a nationality. So I think that, and that's why this group, the religious Zionists, they are really in between the secular majority and the ultra-Orthodox. So that's, I think, it's a key position for them. And they, as you well know, also are today considered the heirs of the Zionist pioneers because they, of the settlements and, of course, of the expansion of Jewish settlement in territories that were taken in 1967. So from all of these viewpoints, the meaning of the Jewish state is perhaps the greatest for those who adhere to national Judaism.
I see. So your book handles some of the most controversial topics regarding the mainstream Zionist narrative. You tackle it from different points of view, and I guess it won't be too smart even to say that the most controversial and the most sensitive topic you handle is the issue of the memorization of the Holocaust, the commemoration of the Holocaust, and the political uses made of it in Israel. Can you give us a sense of your argument in a few words?
Well, again, I'm not the first one to devote some attention to this topic. There are books written about political uses of commemoration of the Nazi genocide. And in fact, I call it Nazi genocide rather than Holocaust because Holocaust, as you well know in Hebrew, means, in fact, something positive. It's a sacrifice. It's a burnt sacrifice in the temple. I don't know why we should use it. It was the innovation of Elie Wiesel, but I prefer the term Nazi genocide, which indeed it was. So the uses of genocide, of the memory of genocide, are quite straightforward because that tragedy in the middle of the 20th century could be interpreted in many different ways. The ways that West German society interpreted what happened at the hands of their parents was that we have to build a democratic, multicultural society that does not discriminate against minorities in order to avoid such tragedy from happening again. For the Zionist leaders, and I think for the Zionist rank and file, it meant something very different. We were weak, we have to be strong. That lesson, in fact, has been engraved in the education system of Israel. You really have this whole apparatus to bring young Israelis, including soldiers, to places of persecution and extermination of Jews in Europe and Poland in particular, with the lesson that we have nowhere else to go. Everyone hates us. The only place we have in the world is the state of Israel. And that's why it is important because everyone tried to kill us. And in that, indeed, that pretty much dovetails with a verse we say during the Passover ceremony, if you remember. In every generation, there are people who come up to destroy us. But the second part, and God saves us from those evil people, somehow is omitted. So what today saves, according to the educational message that is received, today what saves Jews from destruction is the might of the Israeli Defense Forces. And this is the lesson that has been internalized not only in Israel, but in quite a few Jewish communities in the world who enjoy all the benefits of multicultural society, who as Jews benefit from tolerance and lack of discrimination, and at the same time, they believe that the only safe place for the Jews is the state of Israel. And that, I think, is a very important point that the particular people in Western Jewish communities live in a kind of cognitive dissonance. On the one hand, they appreciate and they say so the freedoms of the Western society, but at the same time they say, well, but the only safe place for the Jews is the state of Israel. Mm-hmm.
So this in a way takes us back to the point with which you've started, the role of Israel and its influence in world Jewry. Can you elaborate about this a bit? What does it mean for Israel to be now, as you said in the beginning, the core of many people's Jewish identity outside of Israel?
I've just turned 72, so I remember well many of my friends during sabbaticals that I spent in Israel worked in institutions, one of the main goals of which was to instill the centrality of Israel in Jewish education in the diaspora. I knew them personally. Many of them are still my friends. That has been largely carried out. I think the centrality of Israel has become the main point of Jewish identities around the world, with the exception of ultra-Orthodox groups who are not affected that big practically. This centrality, what it means in practice, and here we're getting perhaps to issues belonging more to diaspora, to Jews living in other countries rather than Israel, is that a Jew can be considered a good Jew if he supports Israel, all the while transgressing all the Torah commandments. In traditional Jewish life, if you transgress Jewish commandments, particularly publicly, you're ostracized, you're really criticized and you're reproached. You're certainly not considered a good Jew. And that's still the case with ultra-Orthodox communities. But in mainstream Jewish communities here in North America that I observe, you can transgress all the commandments, provided you support Israel and give a check to Israeli charities and so on. So, in fact, we have a different system of values, and I'm not saying which is better, which is worse, but it's a new Judaism that has become largely a political identity. You support the most right-wing elements in Israeli political spectrum, and therefore you're a good Jew because you support the most extreme elements. The rest of it, the traditional Jewish identity based on religious commandments, has become secondary or tertiary or has disappeared altogether because, you know, all these people who chant blessing for the state of Israel. Just recently, we are having this conversation after major Jewish holidays. So these people would drive on Yom Kippur to the synagogue, which is not done in Orthodox circles, and then they would sing and chant the blessing for the state of Israel as their expression of Jewish identity. But today, Judaism means many different things. In ultra-Orthodox world, it's pretty much standard Jewish traditional identity. But as we move away from that, we see that it really has become a political identity shared, I would say, by a very large number of Jews. I don't know, Stephen Cohen conducts all this service, so you should check his data, but I think a good majority of Jews identify with the state of Israel much more than they identify with the obligation to eat kosher.
Yes, and in a sense, this new understanding of Jewish identity or of, even of Judaism itself puts everything as dependent on the state. So the state maintains others' identities as Jewish or non-Jewish and so forth. You describe, you position yourself as a Jew vis-a-vis the state.
Well, I personally don't, but yeah, for many Jews, it, The interesting thing is that it's not the real state of Israel. It's not the real Israeli society that is the center of their identity. It's a virtual Israel. It's an Israel that they view from the windows of the Hilton Hotel. It's an Israel that they visit on organized tours where they see the best things of Israel, which is wonderful. But they really don't know very much about Israel. You know, I'll just give you one example. It happened here in Montreal. We have friends of various universities. It's charitable contributions are collected from people who want to contribute, say, to Hebrew University. And among others is the Friends of the Ben-Gurion University in the Negev. That's the official name of the university. And so at a big banquet, which was attended by quite a few people, fundraising, I was seated to a deputy chairman of that organization. Next to her on the other side sat a visiting professor from that university. And she asked him, where do you live? And he said, a certain moshav. Where is this? He says, in the Negev. Oh, where is Negev? And that's the official name of the university. Yes. Yes. So the level of ignorance is quite significant. And I think it's very productive, because it's the best way to support Israel is to know to know less about it.
This would prevent dissonance, where your other values may not sit so well with what the state does.
Right, right. And that's why, in a way, except specialists in Jewish history and Israel studies, the level of understanding of Israeli society is not very good among Jewish communities in the world. And that's why, personally, I found that when my previous book on Jewish opposition to Zionism was translated into Hebrew and in Israel and published, and I was interviewed on television and radio all over, it was much more interesting because people knew what they were talking about. And in fact, the subtitle they gave to the book was A History of a Continuing Struggle. Mm-hmm. For many people here, it's something very exotic. It's something passé, doesn't belong to today's world. But people in Israel do know that a significant part of Jewish population in Israel doesn't even relate to the idea of Jewish state.
I must say that I find the Israeli continuous interest in the opposition of basically a minority among Israeli Jews, well, Israeli by the citizenship, to Zionism tells us a lot about Israel itself, not necessarily about those who oppose it. The amount of energy, the fierceness of the discourse around them, around Neturei Karta, for example, and Haida Haredit, who are famous for their public opposition to the state, is fascinating as a window into Israeli identity.
Yes, and in fact, into Israeli identities, because again, I think that for Russian Jews or for former Soviet Jews in Israel, I don't think they're terribly interested, but I remember, and here I can tell you an anecdote that happened to me. I was, if you know Jerusalem, I was traveling from one campus, the Givat Ram campus, to interview one of the leaders of Neturei Karta, the anti-Zionist movement in the Jewish world. And I took a cab, and there was a traffic jam, and at that time I didn't have a portable telephone. So I asked the driver, who was clearly from an Arab country. He was an Israeli, Jewish Israeli from an Arab country. So I asked him, could he call from his phone and tell the person that I'll be late? He says, what's the name of the person? And I said, well, his name is Rabbi Moshe Hirsch. Oh, he says, the one from Arafat, because he was a member of the Israeli government. Of the Palestinian autonomous government. Mm-hmm. I said, yeah, that's the one. So I didn't know what to expect then. So he dials the number, and then the first thing he says, Kavod Arav, your honor the rabbi.
Yes.
So he has this respect. At the same time, politically, I'm sure he doesn't agree with him. Mm-hmm. But there is a respect for Jewish tradition among particularly non-European Jews in Israel that I think is a very important factor in Israeli life.
Well, Professor Rapkin, we've taken a lot of your time. Can you tell us in closing a little bit about your current work? What are you working on now?
Well, in fact, it's an outgrowth of what we've been talking about, because I'm working now on a collective volume on demodernization. It should come out next year in English. And it deals with the trend that we are all observing around us, that many of the values of modernity have been abandoned, such as, for example, the idea of multicultural society, the idea of development through industrialization, many ideas and projects have been abandoned. For example, another trend is that life expectancy, say in the United States, is going down. So I gathered scholars from 11 countries. We had a conference a year and a half ago, try to understand what demodernization is. And the way it's connected with what we've been discussing today is that Israel itself is a very interesting case of extreme modernization in technological terms, but demodernization in terms of identity and political ideas. Well, because the idea of having an ethnic state is something which cannot be considered a modern idea. In fact, modernity was that you identify with the state not based on ethnic principles. You don't identify with your tribe or with your ethnic group. You identify with the state as it is, or in other words, the state of all its citizens. Mm-hmm. And that certainly is not the case in Israel today, that in fact, even officials openly say that the state belongs not to its citizens, but rather to the Jewish people around the world. And this by itself, this national or tribal identification, is a very anti-modern idea. So in that sense, the Zionist movement itself was the vanguard of this trend, a very early vanguard. And the fact that today Israel is a model for many right-wing groups in Europe also suggests that the Israeli example is very, very interesting in the sense that it combines tremendous technological modernity with political demodernization.
Sounds like a fascinating project. Professor Yaakov Rabin, thank you for being on the show today. I really enjoyed it. Take care and good luck with your future work.
Thank you. All the best to you.